the best things in life for free. If you subscribe to The Spectator, you'll get a whole month for free. And after that, you'll only pay a pound for full access to our website and to our app. And if you want to pay £2, you'll get our magazine too. To claim this offer, go to spectator.co.uk/free.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, The Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Sir Nicholas Mostyn, a British High Court judge who left the bench just a few weeks ago following a long and distinguished career. In 2020, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's and went on to co-create the cult podcast Movers and Shakers, along with Jeremy Paxman and other friends of theirs with the disease. Nicholas, welcome to Table Talk.
I'm very happy to be here.
Nicholas, we're going to start where we always do, at the beginning, and ask you, what are your very earliest memories of food?
I knew this question was coming because you suggested that I listen to some of your previous guests, and I have thought long and hard about this. And the memory is in Nigeria, where I was aged five, I think, in about 1962. That was only 2 years after independence, so it had a sort of strange colonial Evelyn Waugh atmosphere about it, and we lived in a grand house. And the cook brought in this great silver salver and lifted the, are they called salvers? Whatever they're called, and lifted the lid. And there was this enormous yellow vegetable inside, which I'd never seen before. And we all looked at it in amazement, and I was told it was a yam. And that was my, that's my earliest memory of food having an impact on me. That's, I remember that very clearly. And I enjoyed the yam very much.
And what were mealtimes like when you were growing up?
They were quite formal. My parents married incredibly young though. My mother was engaged at 17, married at 18, had me at 19. So they did try, my father was only a couple of years earlier, to have formality, but chaos seemed only just around the corner in mealtimes, and in fact, most aspects of my childhood. So, but there was an attempt to maintain standards.
And what's, apart from the yams, what sort of things would you be eating at these mealtimes? And were they all prepared by the cook?
Yes, they were all prepared by the cook. And I remember going and playing with the cook. I mean, they had about four or five, numerous staff there. And I remember going into the kitchen and playing with the staff and being absolutely fascinated by the food that they prepared for themselves, which was different to ours. And so that was always very interesting. And it was highly formal. It was highly formal. I mean, it was only 2 years after independence. I mean, the place was basically still a British colony. And with all the structures, it's sort of described, it's even more read a book. Do you remember that book? It was all those strange hierarchies were still maintained. You know, drivers. My great uncle at the time, my father's uncle, was this still the GOC of the Nigerian army and lived in this enormous house in the end of, called Flagstaff House, surrounded by a great retinue. So it was a very strange upbringing, and that's all gone now, which is a good thing.
And did your mother like to cook when she had the chance?
She did. She did like to cook, and she was a very good cook, and she was able to produce very good food effortlessly. It was all quite traditional food, but there was never a drama about it, and as long as she was not behaving in a reckless way, food was prepared, good food was prepared, and it was extremely good to eat.
And did she teach you to cook anything?
Ah, yes. I mean, the life of a child, middle class child, brought up in Africa and then brought back and sent to prep school, and you'll no doubt come to that. By the time I got to my second year at Bristol, I had never lived independently. I'd only lived either in institutions, where the food was institutional, or at home. And so at the beginning of my second year at university, I rented a flat, and this was the first time that I was going to have to plough my own culinary furrow. And I remember my mother coming down and with me to establish me in this flat. And she said to me, Nikki, because that was the way we were called, I was calling the family. She said, I'm going to teach you three essential life skills, with which you will be, the world will be your oyster, and you will nothing, and life will hold no terrors at all. And these are the three essential life skills. And they are as follows. Number one, how to clean your lavatory. Number two, how to make gravy. And number three, how to make a white sauce. Now, I'm not, as it happens, those three have served me in good stead. Although I think white sauce, you don't make white sauce very often now. One doesn't. I mean, I can't remember making a white sauce in the last 5 years, actually. But, back in the day, one used to make when. And then the other thing she taught me to cook, she said, a very versatile dish to prepare is bolognese, she said, because it can be used in so many different ways. It can be used, of course, as the name suggests, as bolognese. It can be used as cottage pie. It can be used even to stuff a marrow. And it can be used just neat. And it's an extremely useful thing to prepare. You can prepare it in bulk at the beginning of the week and eat it continuously. I thought, what's all good advice? She said, however, I am going to admit that my recipe is regarded as heretical. And because I put in it sweet corn. And she said, I maintain that this is what makes it, this is the secret ingredient, but you will be told if you serve, you will be told when you serve it up, people will look at you as if you've committed some terrible moral offense. And so, as it happens, one of Liz's closest friends, who's nothing, we'll call Alex, who's nothing if more outspoken, when I told her this, looked at me as if I had actually been found in committing some terrible offense of moral degradation. And she, in fact, has now challenged me to a cook-off where she will prepare her bolognese and then I will prepare my bolognese and then our spouses will blindly assess which is the better version. But that's basically it was the extent of the culinary education I had, which has served me in quite good stead, actually.
Yeah, it's a pretty good repertoire for what, a 19-year-old boy at that point.
There was then the key, the pièce de résistance, was a pudding, which was a trifle. And she taught me how to make this, and she said, this will serve you a good stead. And I can tell you this story now, I can tell it later, but there's a very, very good story about my mother's trifle and having to search Chelsea high and low for the ingredients.
Tell us.
Her trifle has to be made in a very specific way. First of all, it has to have at the base the jam roll, not Swiss roll, because it can't have that horrible cream in, it's got to be jam roll, okay? And then you have to have tinned raspberries, which are tinned raspberries. They sound quite straightforward, but in the syrup, tinned raspberries in syrup. And then you have to have bananas. And then you have to have custard. But it can't be just nice custard you buy from Marks and Spencer. It has to be bird's custard because it has to be able to set with a sort of skin on the top. And then you put whipped cream on top of that. And then you put almonds on top of that. And So I told Liz that this was our signature, and she looked at me as if I had gone quite mad. And she said, "You can't eat that. There's virtually nothing natural in that at all." And I said, "Yeah, but it does taste absolutely delicious." And I said, "As we've got this very good friend of ours called Olivier, who's, as the name suggests, French, and he's a gourmet and a gourmand, and he's highly critical of English cooking. He regards us all as basically being culinary barbarians." And I said, "Well, I'm going to make this trifle." She said, "But he'll never speak to us again. You can't give him that." And so I said, "I am." And so I went out to try and find the ingredients. Now, you try and find those ingredients in Chelsea. I found a jam roll in Earl's Court. I had a bicycle all the way over to Earl's Court. I found one. The only place I could find tinned raspberries in the whole of Southwest London was in Partridge's, which slightly surprised me. I wasn't expecting them to find them there. Bird's custard, I had to go up to the Tesco's in Cromwell Road, but I tracked that down eventually. And then I was able to make this. And so then Olivia arrived, and then the pudding was produced, and they all And he was given a helping, and we were all looking, thinking maybe this is going to be the end of a beautiful relationship, with horror as he put a spoonful in his mouth and there was a silence, and then he pronounced it to be delicious and had a second helping. So there you are.
Oh, you've done your bit for French Anglo relations on the food front, Nick. Perhaps you don't even want to talk about school food. It was so disgusting. But just to drag you back slightly, what do you have? Any happy memories of school food?
No, none at all. It was, I mean, to think our parents actually paid to send us to these places. I mean, it is, I mean, the school made the school in decline and fall look like an absolute oasis of responsibility and civility. It was the most dreadful school in all its respects, the way that we were treated. Down to the fact there was no heating, right? And the staff were, how would I say this, odd, and the food was absolutely disgusting. And there's a little WhatsApp group of us, five of us, we call ourselves Morton Hall Survivors. I mentioned that I was going on this, and we were all being made feel almost virtually sick thinking about the food of this. I mean, I can't bear to describe it, this pig's liver that we produced, grey pig's liver with tubes running through it, which were big enough to push a pencil through.
Yes.
I think that might be the most disgusting description of food we've had on this podcast.
I haven't got going yet. The scrambled eggs were, we found this because we went and hunted it, was a remaindered supply of powdered eggs from the war. It was over 20 years old, the eggs were. Yeah. It was quite the most... And the bread and butter pudding, I can't tell you. I remember a boy being sick in eating it and then being made to sit there and not allowed to leave until his plate had been cleared, which he'd vomited into. I mean, I tell you that if food like that and conditions like that were meted out in a prison or in a young offenders institute, there would be a Human Rights Act challenge successfully, in my opinion. There would. It would be cruel and unusual punishment. And it was the most psychologically disturbing place. And how our parents could have sent us to such a place and paid money for it is quite beyond me.
Was Ampleforth any better?
Ampleforth was pretty good, actually. Because we didn't have central feeding. The feeding was in houses of 60. So that always makes a difference. But of course, when you arrived and you were on the bottom table, one thing that they did do is that you had to take it in turns to carve. So you learned how to carve, which is a useful skill as well. If you were on the bottom table, by the time the food was served with you, they were finishing on the top table. And so you learned to eat really, really quickly. And so it's a feature of, I think, most people who've been to public schools, is that they all bolt their food because you just get in a matter of seconds before the next course is brought, and then the pudding's been cleared away and everybody's leaving. And so you put up with that. And then, of course, by the time that you made your way up the ladder and it wasn't applying to you, there was no reason why it shouldn't apply to people at the bottom of the ladder. So everybody ate extremely quickly, but the food was fine now. It was absolutely fine.
And then you went on to Bristol. We know you had your bolognese and your trifle to hand. What are your other memories of food during that time of your life?
Well, I only have a vaguest memory of the food in the first year when I was in a hall of residence. And then the next 2 years, I told you about my mother's skills. And then in the third year, I was sharing a house with some marvellous people. And we used to take it in turns. We had to take it in turns to prepare the food. And the thing was to try and make it as cheap as possible. And I do remember that a very good friend of mine called Anna Shaw, who married her, who was Greek, managed to make a moussaka for a whole week, which cost 50p a head for the whole week. So, I'm sure it hasn't really changed, is that you have a limited amount of funds. And so the place where you would make your economies, because you probably didn't make much economies in drinking, is that would be on your food. But you know, there was a skill in being able to eke out what was the allowance or the deemed allowance to. But we ate well at Bristol, I remember, and then I was married shortly after I left Bristol. So, and my wife was a very good cook. So I've been fortunate.
And you were called to the bar in 1981. Mm-hmm. When you were training for the bar, you presumably had a number of qualifying sessions that you had to attend.
Oh yes, and we had to eat lots. You were 30. We had to eat 30. Yeah, we had to eat 30. 20 before you were called and 10 after.
Right. Yeah, it was 12 felt like a lot when I did it. So that sounds like an awful lot. Yeah. Can you tell us, it was Middle Temple, you remember. Tell us about those qualifying sessions.
Well, you had to sit in messes, do you remember? You had to sit in messes of four, and you got a bottle of wine and half a bottle of port for each mess. And you would try and you'd work out which of the barristers didn't drink for religious or cultural reasons, and then you'd go and sit with them.
This sounds very familiar. all tactical, all strategic.
Those were good. I approved of the dinners. I mean, I remember going there, and people like Lord Roskill and Lord Diplock would come and sit and talk to you, and I try and do that myself, and that was highly, highly influential on an impressionable young barrister to be able to be sitting with these legal greats. I mean, of course, it sounds too Barchester for words for your listeners, but I mean to be able to sit down next to Lord Diplock, at one of these qualifying sessions was a great privilege,
And how has the experience differed as going in as one of the greats or as a bencher? Well, how does the food differ? First of all, are you getting the better stuff?
Yeah, we all eat the same food.
Fine.
Yeah, well, I can't remember that. I don't know whether they have better food on the high table, but when we sit on the high table, we'd have the same young barristers have, and then we mingle with them. And yes, I'm going in the week after next to one where they're having a dinner for all the scholars, because my most recent judicial assistant got a scholarship, and they have a very good dinner for all the scholars. And one has to try to do as much as that as one can. I don't do as much as I should, but now I'm retired, I will be able to do more contribution to the inn than I have been doing.
And Nicholas, during your days when you were in court, what's the food like in that sort of situation? Where would you be eating? Just a sandwich?
Oh, just a sandwich. Some people go down and eat in the hall in the inns of court, but I don't do that. Because I always used to work during lunch. Always was working during lunch. Subject, of course, to what you're going to ask me about, which is when you're out on circuit and you're in judges' lodgings, which is where one organises, because at home... I'm very lucky to be married to the most wonderful woman in the world, who is very concerned about my diet. She accepts that I'm not a heavy drinker, but I am a heavy eater. And she refers to my midriff as the massif central. And the metaphor we use is that I'm on a diet of Benacol and dust. When I'm at home, so when I escape, this is now all history. But when I go out to the judges' lodgings, that is the place where you can organise, because it's the judges' lodgings. You have wonderful cooks there, and they will cook whatever you want. And so that is where I have my comfort food.
So what are you ordering in those circumstances? What is comfort food for you?
I can't tell you how delicious. On my birthday, which was the last night I was going to spend in judges' lodgings in my career, right? So it was coming to an end. It was in Swansea, my favourite lodgings, where they've looked after me wonderfully over the years, been there 14 times and tried some very difficult cases down there, which is one of the reasons why it would not be appropriate for judges to go to a hotel. I'll just make sure that I make that point. I mean, the idea that you could end up, sitting at a dining room table next door to one of the defendants. So I was in Swansea, and it was my birthday, and I had I held a party for all the local judiciary and all people who'd looked after me as high sheriffs. And I thought, I'm going to have the very acme of comfort food. And so the menu was coronation chicken, followed by Eton mess. By cheese, Now, what could be better than that? For 30 people. And it also means that for breakfast, I can have proper full English on 3 days a week and kippers on Friday. So, I mean, as you can see, this is just absolutely perfect. And so that is when you ask me the question of as a professional, I mean, food doesn't really feature at all, except when I was able to eat very well at the judge's lodgings.
And Nicholas, you during your career, you earned a few notable nicknames, one of which was Mr. Payout and also Mostyn Powers, according to our notes.
It was all invented by the
tabloids.
Yes,
no. Would you ever go out with your clients to celebrate, or is that sort of frowned upon in the?
I did occasionally. I did it once or twice. I never. It's interesting. I never formed a friendship with a client. I mean, you got on very well with them, but then you said goodbye because the relationship fundamentally is professional. And I would not have counted any client as a friend. Sometimes you would go out if you'd had a great victory. But I always thought that was rather, inappropriate, really. But it was a handful of occasions. But no, I didn't do that. No.
You count hunting as one of your hobbies.
Can't do this. You can't have
no. It. But no. Are you a fan of game as a food, or was it hunting as a pastime that mainly appealed to you?
Well, I used to say hunting. I mean, you went out until the ban, and then it was very clear after the ban that when I went out, they were only drag hunting. But before the ban, I never saw a kill ever, not once. Maybe I was just too slow at the back, but I never saw, and I never even heard of one. I mean, I think I may have heard one, but and then the ban came, and I was very, very careful that the hunting I did was lawful, and I only went out with drag hunting. But even now, I think it's become. I don't think it's reasonable, but it has become now unacceptable to be even involved in drag hunting. I don't understand why, but so I'm going to give that up as well. Have given that up. So, shooting, I tried to do that. My shotgun certificate came up for renewal. I didn't even try to renew it. I thought with a Parkinson's tremor, there's no way they're going to let me renew that. So that's a good thing. And so do I like game? Not particularly.
Nicholas, tell us about your Parkinson's diagnosis, and perhaps particularly kind of how it's affected what you eat and drink, or even if it has affected what you eat and drink.
Yes, I was diagnosed in May 20, and I went put on a drug regime immediately. And you'll understand that the effect of Parkinson's is that neurons that produce dopamine are dying in my brain. Well, they're dying in yours, but they're dying at a much faster rate in mine. And you have to have levodopa, which is basically dopamine substitute. And you have to be careful about what you eat, because if you eat incorrectly, it will stop the levodopa working. Also, there are foods that you can eat which will improve matters for you symptomatically, because they will reduce neuroinflammation. So, and then there are also other ones which, for reasons that nobody quite understands, that if you eat a lot of flavonoids, not too much, more than average amount of flavonoids, it seems to extend life expectancy. Although I have to say, an extra couple of years in a wheelchair, it's not really a great dividend. So the important thing is, I mean, without going into the science of it, we are going to have a episode shortly on diet when we will have some good expert talking about this, is basically you should have a Mediterranean diet. You should eat a Mediterranean diet. And what's more, you must take your levodopa either before or after you eat on an empty stomach. You must not take it at the same time.
as an empty stomach because it will not work. And if you take it at the same time as you as cheese or dairy products, it definitely will not work at all. And so you will have it will it, you will go off very, very badly, and you will start feeling quite odd. So so you must be low in protein, high in Mediterranean star vegetables, high in flavonoids, which are dark vegetables. And the key, and you've got to have more than average vitamin C and more than average B12. Those are the key things. And then the final thing is you must take more probiotics. So, I mean, you can do those naturally with that sort of that ghastly stuff, kimchi and things like that. But you just buy this stuff called Simprove, which is in the fridge. And that seems to, the probiotics does seem to reduce neural inflammation. And so your diet can make a considerable difference to how you, your experience of it. I mean, the doctor who's going to appear on our show, Dr. Batsu, says, she was talking to a patient the other day, said, it's very odd, he said, the levodopa works in the morning and it works in the evening, but not the one I take at lunchtime. She said, well, have you thought about why it doesn't work at lunchtime? Are you taking it at the same time you're eating lunch? Yes. Well, there you go. So, so B12, I mean, we all have to take B12. It's interesting, beta, where do you get B12 for if you're vegan? I mean, what do you have to go? Because it's normal. B12 is the animal product in animal, from animal produce, isn't it? I think you have, if you're a vegan, you have to get your B12 from a supplement somewhere.
They supplement some vegan products with B12. So some plant milks and soy products are supplemented with them anyway, I think.
Yes, I think that's very, I mean, B12 is absolutely essential for life. There's no doubt about that. I mean, you can't live without B12. But B12 is very, very important if you've got Parkinson's, to keep your levels of that up. So I do, if you try and eat a Mediterranean diet, then that will alleviate the symptoms. There's no doubt about that.
Nicholas, for listeners who perhaps aren't aware of Movers and Shakers, could you perhaps tell us a little bit about how and why you went about setting it up?
Well, I have to admit that it does seem to have been my idea. because I was asked to write a piece by this marvelous editor of something called Spring Chicken, which is a website principally read, not principally, but largely read by in people of a certain age in the north of England. And she said, could you write the official history of how Movers and Shakers came to be? And I said, well, it's obviously going to be Rory's idea, but it wasn't, it was my idea. And he and I had been got together and we were chewing the fat and having a laugh and having a moan mainly. And then we got Jeremy Paxman in, and then he brought in Paul Mayhew Archer and Gillian, and we were all sitting around about two in the beginning of 2022, and I said, we should write, this is all very useful, this information we're exchanging with each other. I mean, it's certainly opened my eyes about how one can address the problems of Parkinson's, and it's certainly made me much more confident about what the future might hold and how I might address it. I said, we should write a book about it, to which Jeremy said, that's the most crap idea I've ever heard. Okay, right, okay. So that was crushed. And then I said, well, what about doing a podcast, I think they're called. And they looked at me and they said, do you know what a podcast is? I said, well, not really. It's a sort of pre-recorded radio program, isn't it? Which hasn't got the tyranny of recording schedules. And you can just put it out when you want. They said, that's more or less it. And I said, don't you think that would be, wouldn't that be a good idea? Like this. I said, come on, I mean, it'd be quite a good idea. And so I was sort of casting around for, because it was made clear to me that the podcast would only be successful if we had a really, really good producer, as you know, because that's why you're so successful. The difference between a podcast that is listened to and one that is not listened to is the producer, they say. I was put in touch with your husband, Laura, who put me in touch with Nick Hilton, who is a man of exceptional talent.
Yeah, he actually used to work at The Spectator as well, so
he trained. This is the first time apparently it's been attempted with six principles. Well, I expect it has been attempted with six principles, but
not that it's commonplace. I mean, when we did the first one, you could see him, because this is not being filmed, but you could see him at the end of the table, like this. Head in his hands.
Where do you record it?
In the pub. Oh. That was Jeremy's idea, because we were meeting in the pub. We said we should carry on doing it in the pub. So we only do it in the pub. We don't do anything by video. We don't have any guests by video. You have to be there in the flesh. There has to be the sound of clanking glasses. And I'm not saying that we are not having a natural dialogue. We are having a natural dialogue, but the idea, the sort of the principle that underlay our idea was that we were going to extend the pub. People were going to be invited into the pub. And so it was a very good idea of Jeremy's. And so, of course, with five journalists, they know exactly how to promote it. But even allowing for that, we've been absolutely taken by surprise about how popular and successful it's been. I mean, I was just listening to Gillian, who was on the Scottish. One of the side effects of the drugs that she's on is that she's become incredibly creative, and she's written a musical, which is on at the Edinburgh Fringe at the moment. So I went up on a day trip to Edinburgh to watch it yesterday. And yesterday morning, she was interviewed on the Scottish local programme, and she described the interviewer, whose name I've forgotten, but her brother is Roddy Forsyth, the famous football commentator in Scotland, who has just been diagnosed with Parkinson's. But she described it on the show as the cult podcast. I thought, cult, my God. but that's how it was described. So we've been absolutely bowled over. And I think the reason that it's been so successful and that we've been so humbled by its success is that it's quite a good story about coping with adversity and different ways. I mean, Jeremy's at one end of the spectrum, and I would say that Paul and I at the other end of the spectrum, the others are in between. And the fact is that those of us who are more Pollyanna-ish, those of us who are more Tiggerish, have been able to help those who feel more gloomy and Eeyore-ish and blue about it. And I said, well, if we can do that in our little group, why can't we do it for the whole Parkinson's world? Not necessarily the Parkinson's world. Why can't the way that one addresses this problem, why can't that apply to countless other conditions, you know, the people with cancer and things like this? And, you know, that, you know, if you carpe the diem, as you wouldn't say, or as I say, give the condition the finger, then you can live a life which is, whatever your condition, which is pretty tolerable. I mean, obviously, if you were going to hospital to have blood transfusions or have your dressings changed on a daily basis, that would be a very difficult thing to have a stiff upper lip about. But, I mean, so I'm not saying that it's going to be of universal assistance, but I mean, so the whole idea was to first of all increase awareness of the condition, which is scandalously unstandardized in its treatment throughout the United Kingdom and the world. Everybody seems to deal with it different. There's no standards. To increase public awareness, and then to help people, and more particularly members of their family, people who are caring for them, help all of those people to try to cope better. That's why the episode entitled Coping was so successful.
That then feels very in keeping with this idea of it being in the pub, that sort of socialisation almost between the principals and the guests coming on. Do you drink? You say the clanking of glasses. Do you have a normal order whilst you're doing that sort of thing?
I only have alcohol when it's out.
Right.
As you can see, because Mark Mardell ruthlessly mocks, the judge's pink tonic water has been served.
Sounds like a cocktail.
But there's no prescription on it, and Jeremy definitely has a pint of beer when we do it, because we want to make it as natural as we can. But that's fine. But I should say, although red wine is a flavonoid, and so along with chocolate, is a good thing. Too much is a bad thing because it stops the levodopa working properly. Too much of any alcohol is a bad thing. And when I say too much, I mean, you really can't have more than a glass and a half, because otherwise it will affect how the levodopa works.
Nicholas, when you're at home, do you like to cook? What are the kind of family meal times like nowadays?
Well, Liz and I, Liz is a good cook, but she is very, very conscious of the fact that I am, as I said, a heavy eater. So we eat light at home because we do have a fairly active social life, and going out socially does involve eating. And so, but when I have my children round or my grandchildren round, it's quite traditional, you know, roast chicken, you know, roast potatoes. We had some friends to stay when we were in France who he taught me how to make a forestier sauce. So I'm going to, that's going to be the next experiment when I do a roast chicken. It's very delicious, I have to say. And mustard and mushrooms are marvelous. And sort of simple, nothing too complex. And the pudding would be the sort of staple ones that I've been mentioning before. If I'm having my, you know, children around for a Sunday lunch. But if it's just us at home, you know, it'll be roast vegetables, or smoked salmon or something like that. I mean, one tries to rein in one's greedy instincts.
Now, we normally finish by asking guests what their desert island meal is, or, I mean, a sort of death row meal, although that always sounds a little bit bleak.
Well, the death, I think they're two different ones, aren't they?
Some guests feel like we're sort of asking them to survive in a desert island, and that's not really what we're asking. We're asking ultimate meal, but I mean, have we covered it? Is it coronation chicken and eaten?
No. The death row meal would be a full English,
right?
That would definitely be a full English. But the desert island one, I've been thinking more again, reaching back to my childhood. When I was in my teens, I went out one summer holiday to visit my father, you know, because I was at boarding school, who had moved with BAT from Nigeria to Venezuela and then from Venezuela to El Salvador. And so I went out and he said, Nicky, we're going down to the beach club this week, today, on Saturday, him, my stepmother, Ana Julia, and we're going down to the Deportivo Beach Club, which is on the Pacific. So we drove down to the beach club and went in, and this enormous sort of luxury club there with sweeping black sand because of the sand in volcanic country. And the blue Pacific rolling in, roiling and boiling in. And we positioned ourselves under a tree, and we put on hammocks or rugs and things. And then a band appeared, and he was called El Ostrero. And I said, what's this? And he said, this is part of your education. This is the oyster man. And he will stay here for as long as we want. And we will eat as many oysters as we can. And so we just started eating oysters. We ate oysters the whole afternoon. And at the end of it, my father announced it to be a very good day because we ate 10 dozen oysters.
Amazing.
my desert island food would be oysters.
Delicious.
I love oysters.
I know you've got an event coming up for Movers and Shakers.
We're having our first live event, taking place in the Middle Temple Hall, where I was called to the bar.
Okay.
We had a maximum of 300 tickets. We put them on sale. They were sold within an hour. And that's taking place on the 6th of September. It's going to be in two parts. It's going to be as basically a podcast session as if we're in the pub, although the pub has moved into the Middle Temple Hall. So, and then the second part is going to be a question and answer session, question time style. And it's going to be streamed, and this none of the others, of course, have done events like this. I've done nothing like this, so I shall be very interested to see how it goes. But we're hoping to try and continue the atmosphere of the pub as best we can. But and we've asked people to write in with their questions, and we've had some very interesting questions arrive already. So it should be an interesting event. That is going to be a one-off. We're going back to the pub. There's no secret about this. We've already started recording some of the episodes for series two. So we've got some very interesting stuff. We've had a very interesting one about sleep recorded, because disturbed sleep is a very, sleep dysfunction is a very common non-motor symptom of Parkinson's. We've had one about, a very good one about bedside manner, about how consultant neurologists seem to be universally hopeless at dealing with initial diagnosis. And we had very interesting discussions about that. And then we've got coming up one on diet, which we prefigured in this. And then we've got one coming up about tech, you know, about technological assistance people can get. So we've got some very interesting stuff coming up. And we've got sponsorship for the whole of Series 2 and sponsorship for the whole of Series 3. So that's very exciting. So,
brilliant news. Well, Nicholas, thank you very much for joining us on Table Talk.
My pleasure. I've enjoyed it very much.
And for any listeners who would like to tune in on the 6th of September to hear Movers and Shakers live, just go to YouTube and search for Movers and Shakers live, where you'll be able to find the relevant link. Or alternatively, you can also look on the Spectator's website, where you'll also find a link.
Thank you for joining us on the Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website. Yeah.